countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
But first...
Now, John, good afternoon.
That's Joe Duffy.
Good afternoon, Joe.
John, you contact the programme.
It's last Thursday week's live line, and he's taking a call from John Tethers.
You're a farmer.
John's an organic farmer from Shrule on the Mayo-Galway border.
I'm a small-time farmer.
Small-time farmer.
And this is why he decided to talk to Joe.
So, normally I have a number of customers that would dealt with me over the last number of years. But last year there was one particular guy and he got 10, 15 turkeys, which was fine. Yeah. And he put in an order for another 70 this year. Last week I gone to him just to see if everything was okay, because I hadn't really heard from him to say that that the turkeys weren't really moving for him, and that sadly he would be able to take them off me. So at this stage I'm in a rather predicament.
So what happened was, an order was placed with John earlier this year for 70 more turkeys from one of John's customers last year, but the order was cancelled when the customer told John a few weeks ago that he'd no buyers for the more expensive organic turkeys, which were now fully reared on John's farm, but with nowhere to go.
I mean, it's devastating now. It really is.
And by the way, will you... Okay, I'll buy it to... I buy a turkey off you.
Then the calls now began to come in.
Sure, but I'm going to get two turkeys off that man.
Okay, I mean, well, there. Well, it looks like, it's early yet, but it looks like, looking at the screen, that we're going to shift a lot of your turkeys, I hope.
I hope so, Joe.
Well, I'm actually here now in Shrule, on a farm just outside Shrule on the Mayo-Galway border, here with John Tethers. And John, I'm going to find out how you actually get on following your appeal on Liveline. But tell us a little bit more about the farm here.
I grew up on the farm here in Shrule. It was obviously handed down to me from my dad. My dad would have maybe 10, 15 cattle running along with maybe 50 sheep. Mm. And he'd have a few hens, and that was really it.
John has a mixed organic enterprise. He gets the turkeys as young chicks in July and rears them till now.
At the minute, we have some dry stock, and as I said, I do the turkeys for Christmas, and then I've laying hens as well.
Now, yeah. And you know the way a lot of people say we should move away from, you know, the intensive or industrialised agriculture, maybe go back, destock a little bit, think more organic, but can you make money?
Well, again, I suppose you're not going to make a fortune, trust me.
Yeah.
But at least, like, yeah, there's more. You're thinking more of the animal, more the welfare of the animal at the end of the day. And I think, look, it's not all about money either. If you can make enough to pay the bills and to make ends meet, what more do you want?
But I suppose even conventional farmers would say, well, you know, we think a lot of the land as well, and we think a lot of our animals too. We just mightn't be certified organic.
Well, I suppose. Look, I suppose everybody's different.
Yeah.
You know, it just depends on your mindset.
You've 70, and what has happened to the market? Is it because a lot of supermarkets are selling fresh? It's advertised fresh turkeys for a tenner.
Yeah, I think this is the start of it now. I mean,
and do you think that was probably the root cause of your problem in the last few weeks as well? That you ended up with a surplus of turkeys that you thought you were going to sell. The butcher couldn't find a home for them because he was probably being undercut by cheaper imports, and again, people looking for cheaper food. Do you think that was at the root cause of your last ditch call to Liveline?
Absolutely, I think so. Yeah. That was in the back of my mind all along. I mean, you hear advertising turkeys for 10 euros, and of course that was playing on my mind.
So you're at the end of your tethers.
Pretty much.
when you rang Joe, and you sounded very emotional, and people called in then to support you.
Yeah, they called in their hundreds, and all I can say is thank you so much to everyone that helped me out. Again, all I can say is thank you so much.
Well, you're after giving it away there. I was going to ask you, how did you get on? Did the Liveline listeners come to the rescue? Did you get rid of all of the turkeys?
All except three. I have three turkeys here.
That's the sound of them in the background. We'll go over towards them. Okay.
So I must have got at least 600-700 emails.
Wow.
Plus a load on Facebook. So, and people are just ringing. Obviously, they got my number on Facebook. They're just ringing, and they're still ringing. And I mean, even to this morning, people are just ringing in constantly. Like, obviously, I'm just telling them that I'm sold out, but they're still, they're so happy that it worked out.
And that's the power of Liveline.
Thank you very much, Joe.
So you have three left here.
Yeah, so there's one.
Who are they for?
One for myself, obviously.
Yeah.
One for my sister, Claire, that works for me. And one for Joe, of course.
Is that the fattest one there?
It's
in the middle?
The fattest one in the middle, that's for Joe.
Well,
we'll get it up to Joe. Don't tell him not to panic.
The call to Liveline, it worked, and I'm delighted for you.
Thank you very much.
The very best of luck to you, and a happy Christmas to you.
And you too.
Happy Christmas.
No, it is Countrywide you're listening to, and that was John Tedders there of Down to Earth Organics in Shrewell, County Mayo. He also owns the Filling Station Eco Store in Abbeygate Street, just off Shop Street in Galway. Drop in and say hello to him and his family there who run it with him. And remember, support Irish farmers and small shops in rural towns this Christmas. Now, there's been a lot of discussion recently, both in the online and in the physical world, about methane emissions, with a paper recently being shared from the UK, seeming to suggest that methane from cows was less damaging than we thought. Now, it'd be great news for Ireland if it was true, but unfortunately, like many other things, it's complicated. Suzanne Campbell is with me. You've been doing some digging, Suzanne.
I've been doing some digging. I went down to Kildare to UCD Lyons' farm to meet Professor Tommy Boland, and I went to him to talk cows and methane research, and I also went to Maynooth University to meet really the most senior climate scientist in Ireland, Professor Peter Thorne. He took over from the famous John Sweeney, of course, who really alerted us about 25 years ago to climate changing and global warming in this country. So Peter Thorne is at the ICRIS unit. He's a lead author also to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And first, I wanted to, you know, demystify all this talk about methane, get the basics out there and delve into it, how long it lasts in the atmosphere, how harmful it is. So I asked Peter firstly to take us through the basics.
Methane hangs about for about a decade. So if I emit a ton of methane today, in about a decade's time, there will be about half a ton left. Methane itself, though, is a very, very active greenhouse gas relative to carbon dioxide. So every molecule of methane is 80 times more powerful than a molecule of carbon dioxide.
And it's powerful at what? Heating, trapping light? What way does it work?
All of the greenhouse gases act by intercepting outgoing long-wave radiation from the planet. They intercept it and then they re-radiate it in all directions.
So this idea that if we stopped the herd figures as they were today, for example, in Ireland, beef, livestock and cows, our methane figures would remain the same over the next 50 years or would they lower? Because we'd be replacing those animals but more, but just stopped expanding. How would that work?
So yes, indeed. If we kept the stock still over a prolonged period of time, the total amount of methane in the atmosphere would stand still. Now, there are a couple of problems with that. The first is that methane, 90% of methane's escape from the atmosphere is via oxidation, which produces two greenhouse gases, water vapor, which really doesn't matter, it rains out almost instantaneously, and carbon dioxide. The second problem is that methane is already elevated far more than the other long-lived greenhouse gases. It's 150%+ higher than it was in the pre-industrial period. And that's a major problem. It accounts for one third of the total global warming we're seeing today. And if you look at the special report on 1.5 from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they say if we don't act on these short-lived climate forces such as methane, we have virtually no chance of keeping global warming below 1.5 or maybe even 2 degrees centigrade. So there's no way of getting around that the way that we currently are performing our agriculture is highly climate damaging.
I mean, he's pretty clear here, Damien. No matter what we think about methane, the basics are that it's really damaging. And a third of our greenhouse emissions in Ireland are coming from farming, mostly methane from livestock. Now, the defence we hear from the farming sector, and we hear this on this programme all the time, in public debates and on discourse online about it, is that we produce food very efficiently in Ireland. And if we don't produce beef and dairy from a relatively green system that we have here, which is an outdoor extensive system, well, an outdoor system and a low emission system that farmers say we have in Ireland, somewhere else will produce these foods. Somewhere like Brazil, who will pull down rainforest, which is, you know, giving us oxygen, taking carbon out of the atmosphere in the process. So isn't it better that we produce it here? But Peter says that the model, in fact, that we are using, that Bord Bia is using, that farm organisations refer to in terms of calculating our farming emissions, mightn't actually be a sound one.
There are different ways of measuring the impact. There are two major international reports, and they fundamentally disagree on how environmentally friendly our farming is. Mm-hmm. So we cannot guarantee that the Irish farming is amongst the most efficient, depending upon which metrics you use.
So is Ireland shouting this figure that we're the most effective and carbon efficient when we're not?
Quite possibly. So the report that is less positive for Ireland comes from the International Food Organization, which is a UN organization. So I would say that we should have a pinch of salt about how self-congratulatory we perhaps are.
And this argument that lesser developed countries will fill that gap, is there anything in that?
Is the gap a real gap, or is the gap a result of the decisions that we and other countries have made to press and really put forward beef and dairy consumption in cultures that have not historically had a beef or dairy take? So there's a question of whether we're talking about a real market or a false market. But absolutely, we should be undertaking efforts to produce the right level of produce in the most efficient way. And that requires us to move away in a way from capitalist or purely capitalist approaches to more capital environmental approaches. We will have to have beef and dairy globally. The question is, where should it be produced most efficiently, both in terms of the cost, but also in terms of the overall global environmental footprint?
Peter also said, and this is really interesting for me, he doesn't want to see the end of beef and dairy animals here, and that there will always be demand there, you know, as he said, for these products. But it's the scale we are farming at now that he's unhappy with. And so is the Climate Task Force, indeed, that relates to government on climate policy and has asked for a reduction in herds. And that also, he said, you know, extensively farmed livestock, lower stocking rates, stick in silver pasture into the equation there, where there are trees that are sucking up carbon, putting out oxygen, can be even carbon neutral, the beef this is, or even carbon positive. And that's really exciting. But we need to see a lot more of this. And we also need to see these food products command a lot more price, or people won't go into that style of farming. It's not worth their while. Then I went down to Lyons' farm to talk to Tommy Boland in UCD. And what he's doing, I suppose, is looking at cattle that are already on the ground, looking at bovine nutrition. How do farmers reduce methane through feeds, through their grassland management? And he told me a little about the work going on at UCD and further afield.
There's also a huge amount of work being done into reducing methane emissions and the environmental footprint of agriculture. And that's occurring nationally and internationally. There's been data in the literature and in the media in recent months about New Zealand breeding low-emitting sheep. There's similar work underway in Ireland looking at identifying animals that are naturally lower in terms of their methane emissions.
Is it a goer?
It's absolutely a goer, but it takes time to get there. The first thing we have to do is measure the methane emissions on the individual animals. We know it varies from animal to animal. And if you want to breed for reduced methane emissions or breed for any trait, the first thing you require is that there is variation within the population for that trait. We know that exists. Now is to identify the animals which are low emitting and to identify the animals which are high emitting. But also, very importantly, when we're looking for low emitting animals, we need to be conscious that we're not having negative impacts on other important traits, let it be animal health or animal productivity or animal efficiency. So it's not just as simple as going out and looking at a single trait. That type of breeding program doesn't work.
So you need a multiplicity of things. Feed, where are we with feed solutions and the marketplace for new feeds, and are they going to be expensive that are methane reducing?
Well, some may be expensive, others don't need to be expensive. We've conducted a lot of work here in UCD with colleagues in Chagas and other institutions nationally and internationally, and doing something simple like improving the quality of grass we feed to our livestock can have big savings in terms of reducing methane emissions. It also has benefits from an animal production point of view. So you don't need to spend a lot of money on feed to do this.
Okay.
And farmers are progressing all the time and taking on this new technology. But again, we need to be very conscious that it's not a one solution fits all. And that type of commentary and that type of narrative can actually be quite damaging. Because certain technologies won't work in certain parts of the country for rainfall reasons, soil type reasons, etc. So we need to come up with a suite of interventions from the feeding perspective. There are then feed additives, which are fed as part of a concentrate, which would include these various products under development with claims of up to 30% reductions in methane emissions. In the last 18 months to 2 years, seaweed inclusion in diets has received a lot of media attention and quite a lot of scientific investigation as well. And some of the benefits that are being reported for seaweed inclusion are quite exciting, but certainly more research is required before they reach a position where they're ready to be rolled out on Irish farms.
Yeah, interesting words there from Tommy Boland at the Lions Estate in UCD.
Farmers blocked the entrance to the Tesco distribution centre in Donabate at 7 this morning.
This week, farmer protests against the low prices they receive for the food they produce continued.
It's shown in the market that the price is there and it's just not being passed back to the farmer. So somebody in the middle is screaming the money.
IFA members held flash protests at the distribution depots of the main retailers from where we buy our food.
How can anyone expect farmers to continue to produce a top quality product and losing €200 a head on it? It's not sustainable.
And when it comes to us buying food in these retail outlets, according to Eurostat, Irish shoppers spend less than 9% of our disposable household income on food.
Where I live, all around that area, 30 years ago, everything was fields of cabbage and broccoli and potatoes. And now they're just gone to hard work and not getting paid for your hard work at the end of the day.
What's more, not only are we demanding cheaper food, but we're also demanding cheaper food that is produced in a safe, traceable, ethical and sustainable manner.
In 2018, Irish food prices were cheaper than they were in 2001.
And these demands combined have consequences for the environment. With this week's EPA report on water quality blaming the increased use of artificial fertilisers from intensive agriculture on the deterioration of the quality of our waterways.
Since 2013, when we started to see a decreasing trend in water quality, we have had an increase in agricultural activity, but we've also had an increase in human population. So there's pressure coming from both those sources.
But I think it's too simple a message to lay the blame exclusively at dairy expansion when we're seeing declines in areas where there hasn't been dairy expansion.
The question is, can we have cheap food produced at the highest standards?
It is an opportunity for our farmers. With our farm-to-fork strategy, from Lapland to southern Italy, a whole generation of young farmers are rediscovering traditional crops and bringing new life to our countryside. The European Green Deal will be on their side.
Ursula von der Leyen, President of the EU Commission, at the announcement of the EU Green Deal this week, which aims to see the EU carbon neutral by 2050. I'm joined in studio now by journalist with the Currency, Thomas Hubert, and from his dairy farm in Clara, County Kilkenny, Bill O'Keefe, and Suzanne Campbell is still with us. Good morning to you all. Thomas, first to you, the farmer protests, that EPA report, the EU Green Deal, and the Eurostat report, which suggests that only the UK spends less than us proportionately on our food and in any given week. What it all combines to tell me is that we want cheap food, but it better be top quality and environmentally sustainable. Is that a fair analysis?
That's the message we're giving to farmers. And on what we spend on food, it's interesting that Eurostat had a lot of figures out this week. And another set they had was that actually food is more expensive in Ireland in euro terms than the EU average, 20% more expensive. But we are one of the richest countries in the EU. So in proportion of what we spend, it's actually not that much. But really, that those retail prices don't tell much about what farmers are getting, because we're exporting so much food, beef, dairy especially. We're importing other things, finished products, biscuits and salads and vegetables and things like that. So what I did on the currency.news this week was look at what the farmers are getting, the farm gate price, and compare that to those EU prices. And really, it's worrying for Irish farmers because it's going down relative to EU levels. Like, it's been all about beef price, and we've heard farmers are getting €3.50 per kg, and it's now 3.60 at EU level, 3.80 in the UK, where most of our beef is eaten. And it's true, they are getting less and less compared to the EU average. I looked at milk, I looked at lamb, I looked at pigs. It's the same. Irish farmers are getting less. And, you know, it's only eggs, barley, where they're getting more than the EU average. And even that's not, right. that advantage is reducing. And at the same time, we have that problem that the EPA noticed that the agriculture pollution is the main source of issues in our waters. So we are sending this message that we want cheap food and we are paying less and less for it. And also we want cleaner waters.
And farmers then, obviously, in using, you know, more fertilizer, are trying, obviously, to improve their margins because they're getting paid so little. So, you know, are we as consumers in Ireland in particular in any position to condemn Irish farmers when we're in a race to the bottom ourselves in terms of what we pay for our food?
That's the crux of the problem. And really, there's 2 points about that. Number one, it's more expensive to farm in a greener way. So if farmers aren't making a living out of what they're selling, how can they invest on top of that to invest in better practices? And the second point is, if the price you're getting for a litre of milk or a pint of milk of meat is lower and lower, then you have to produce more and more from the land you have on your farm. So you're going more intensive. That means more fertilizer, more livestock. And that's when the problems start occurring. That's unless right. you change your practices at the same time as you expand. And you can ask any farmer or farm advisor. That's very difficult to do. So really, like, if you keep buying those 1 euro burgers and those kind of cheap Super 6 and all that, and the 10 euro turkeys we heard earlier, really, you're buying into this and you're effectively subsidizing the bad results in the EPA report.
We're giving out to farmers, they're not looking after the land, and then we're going out to the supermarket looking for the cheapest food. Bill O'Keefe is a dairy farmer. You're milking 300 pedigree cows there on the family farm in Clara County, Kilkenny, Bill. So good morning to you, taking a break from the milking. In Irish terms, you would be considered very intensive with 300 cows, and intensive agriculture is being blamed for everything that's wrong with the environment. How do you respond to that when you read that and hear that?
Yeah, well, intensive, I suppose, is all relative. Look, we have 300 cows, it's three times the average herd size in the Glanbia region, but we've also taken on extra ground for those cows as we've expanded the herd. And I suppose, just for instance, we'd have 30 kilometres of hedgerows on the farm. We've 3 kilometres of a stream that we've fenced off both sides as a stream to keep stock out and keep water quality as good as possible. And yeah, there's 300 cows on the farm, but we like to think there's a lot of room for other wildlife on the farm as well. And we're very proud of the biodiversity on our farm. We have otters, buzzards, hedgehogs, barn owls, long-eared owls, frogs, eels, you name it, we have it on our farm. And I suppose Irish farmers, we're blamed for having an impact on the environment. But I'd see it as Irish farmers are the environment. We're custodians of the environment out there. And we want to do as good a job as possible in that role in Ireland. And we're prepared to take whatever measures are necessary to protect the environment on our farm.
Well, when you see food being used by retailers to woo customers and, you know, you see the growth and the popularity of the discounters, how does that make you feel about your job in the future?
Yeah, it's a tough job. We'd be concerned, I suppose, about the future. We're already jumping through a lot of hoops on the environmental side and trying to do the job as well as possible. But we'd like to see consumers and retailers, I suppose, in particular, valuing our product a bit more and increasing the price of it on the shelf. Yeah. It's a huge issue for us as we go forward. We are producing probably the best quality food in the world. We're trying to do it as sustainably and as ecologically friendly as possible. But we do need to get paid a proper price for that food. Yeah. And it's very worrying to hear Thomas's figures there that we are at the bottom of the food prices in Europe. And yeah. probably doing as good or better a job as any of the other countries out there.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, Thomas is saying that Irish farmers are getting paid less than the European counterparts, and in other European countries, consumers are actually paying more proportionately weekly for their food. Suzanne, on that point, have we as consumers totally lost respect for the value of food, what's involved in producing the food that feeds us every day of the week, while at the same time we're blaming farmers for climate change?
Yeah, I think we have a very complex behaviour around food and what we spend on food. Irish spend on food outside the home is growing. So people spend on pizzas, on garage lunches, on dashboard driving.
That's right, we had that discussion a few weeks ago.
Yeah, so that is on the rise. And then people also will, kind of style themselves as foodies, very interested in different and interesting chefs, trying out new restaurants, and also looking at very Irish-sourced food. At the same time, your average chicken in your average supermarket at the lowest price is €3. How can really you square that against the price of a coffee, which is water and coffee grounds?
A bag of chips is more expensive than a bag of potatoes as well.
Completely. And we have this kind of anachronistic and complex sets of behaviours. And then we'll say, well, the farmers are wrecking the environment because look at the EPA figures on the water quality decline. I think a lot of it is to do really with that we are separated from what actually people get paid for food. And also something that's very, really the elephant in the room on this is that the supermarkets and processors have really had free rein in the marketplace for really a decade, two decades or more around the price of food. We saw the share of what we spend on food going from 17% about 15 years ago down to 8.7% this week. That's a huge drop.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that the farmers have had that drop in price just because our price drop has that our income spend has dropped, but it's because of this nature of this severe competition in the marketplace. You cannot perform as a supermarket in Ireland now unless you have prices kind of on the level or competing with your competitors. We're in a completely competitive market compared to a lot of different places in Europe, and that's why our food prices are so low, and that's what brings us in the door.
Okay, Thomas, on the EU Green Deal, we heard a clip there. It's Europe's man in the moon moment, according to the EU Commission President. The IFA President Joe Healy said this week, a shrinking common agricultural policy budget, remember the UK will no longer be contributing, it's shrinking, right, this budget which farmers need to survive, it can no longer be used to address the growing number of asks placed on a farmer. So can targets be achieved with a dwindling cap? Can all these targets and demands on farmers be achieved when we won't pay for the food and when the common agricultural policy budget is dropping?
The answer is in your question, when we don't pay for the food. So if it's a political choice, if we cut the cap, and it's not only the UK, it's part of it, the UK contribution diminishing or going away completely, but also money being relocated elsewhere. There are other political priorities, security, migration and all that the EU wants to address. So if we make that choice, we reduce cap. CAP is 75% of farmers' incomes in Ireland on average last year. So that means either we're going to up food prices and keep them in business, or we're making the choice of putting a lot of those farmers out of business by those CAP cuts. Like, really, that's the choice on the table. If that's the case, then if we want to raise prices as consumers, that's a choice we can make. And in France, where I'm from, as you can hear from my accent, there's a new brand started a few years ago called Who's the Boss? And the answer to that question, they said, is the consumer is the boss. So they did a survey of consumers. What do you want in the price of your liter of milk? Are you prepared to pay extra for this and that? And people said, we're prepared to pay extra for farmers' income, a bit more, for better welfare for animals and quality of feed and all the environmental aspects connected to that. So they came up with the final price of 99 cents for a litre of milk instead of 70 cents. It's been 3 years, it's flying off the shelves, and they're now moving into other products, and they now have yogurt and apple juice and all that, and it's one of the most popular brands in France, so maybe people here would be happy to look at that as well.
Okay, Bill, we've 30 seconds left. Do you see the EU being carbon neutral by 2050, and do you have a role, you do have a role to play in that? Can you help achieve it?
Yeah, we can, and we're already helping to achieve it, Damien. We have €2.5 billion spent on Irish farms over the last number of years on pollution control and trying to improve practice. You have 8 acres of forestry, or 8% of the, or 11% of the country is covered in forestry already, but we need to get, right, I suppose, credit for the carbon sequestration that that's doing. And we need to get credit for what farmers are already doing. We have an ASAP program there that's working on water quality across 200 water catchments across the country. And we have 20 people full-time employed on trying to improve water quality in a proactive way on farms. Farms are prepared to put their shoulder to the wheel. We need to get rewarded for it in terms of getting credit for what we've already done.
Okay.
And in terms of a sustainable price going forward.
All right. Well, listen, we let you back to the milking there. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill O'Keefe there in Kilkenny. Thank you indeed to Thomas Hubert, and the best of luck to you in the currency.
Thank you.
Of course, to our own Suzanne Campbell, and a happy Christmas to you all. Now, in the rolling pastures of East Cork near Ballynoam Village, the Dineen family have been farming the land for 5 generations. But in order to secure the farm for the next generation, husband and wife team Tom and Nora decided to diversify into cheese making. That was in 2016, and now they've their own cheese and a dairy on the farm, and recently won the Rising Star Award at the Irish Independent Farmer of the Year Awards. Brenda Donoghue visited Borua Farm and met Tom and Norma, along with their children, Maeve, Anya and Ty.
I'm the head cheesemaker here at Boro Farm, and Tom, when I need his help, particularly when filling curd into cheese moulds, which is probably the most physical part of the job, he'll come in and help me for an hour or two in the day maybe.
Yeah, so into this room, this is where we pack our cheese, and we take full control of the process, so we can cut the rounds of cheese ourselves, we can back and pack it, and we also then have a walk-in fridge for dispatch before it goes to retail.
Then once the cheese is made, it needs to be very well cared for while it's maturing. Once a week we'll come in here and turn every single cheese, and we'll also grade each batch to see how they're maturing, whether the taste is coming on as we had anticipated, and to be quite honest, I find it very satisfying.
First you start off with really good milk and you put it into the vat.
Then you add the rennet and the cultures, and it turns the milk into a gel.
Then you get curds and whey.
Then you separate the curds from the whey and you put them in the cheese moulds, and then you press on them really hard.
And a few years later, you end up with cheese.
1 year later.
1 year. 1 year.
And Tom, in terms of cheese making, the time of the year, where are we at?
Sure. So at the moment, we're finished making for the year. We only make cheese when the cows are on grass. Yeah. So kind of roughly from some data in March, say Patrick's Day, when the cows are out full time and things are settling down. And we can make then right up until middle of October, depending on how the back end of the year goes. Sometimes we get until the start of November, but we'd be happy once we get to the 15th of October. Yeah, so we'll take a walk out now and we'll have a look at the cows. They're in now for the winter, but we'll just see how they're getting on.
How did both of you meet, Norma? I mean, was it a love of farming, or how was it?
We met 17 years ago, and it was through our involvement with Machrane Ferma, of all things. So at the time, I think I was secretary in the Ina Shannon Machrane Club, and Tom was a Cork County Chair, and we met through friends through that. So,
if I recall, I think I was looking for sponsorship for doing a cliff walk down in Ballycotton or something, and I just approached someone I didn't know called Norma and said, yeah, would you like to sponsor me? And I didn't collect too much more sponsorship after that night, I'm afraid. We just got talking and it went from there.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
We're in the farmyard now, Tom, and Mount Bellyard and Frisian cows?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So we have Mount Bellyard cows. They're a French Alpine breed. They're from the Jura region of France, and they're renowned for cheese making. Their milk has certain properties that just lend itself to making a nicer, smoother cheese. They've been bred for generations out in France for cheese making, and they're nice animals to work with. We like them, and their red and white colour is quite appealing to the eye, just something different.
And they've very much, I suppose, inspired the name of our farm and our cheese. Borua, of course, Bo translates to cow, while Rua is red. So hence the name.
Environmental sustainability is a really important idea now, and many farmers have changed the way they farm, I suppose, to bring their way of doing things up to the highest possible standards. Now, I mean, how have you done that, or what have you done?
We are very fortunate that we're part of the BRIDE project. It's a local project which has got funding from Europe to help with the biodiversity and help with the sustainability piece in intensive dairy farming. And I suppose for me, it's something that I'd always been interested in. A couple of years ago, I started off by putting in a white thorn hedge and that kind of thing. But since we joined the BRIDE project, we got to work with an ecologist, and he's visited the farm. That's been a game changer, really, because we'd been kind of trying to do things and going along by the edges and thinking that we were doing great, but we actually weren't doing near enough. So since we joined the BRIDE project, we have put in a multi-species hedge. It's something that's going to be, there's 13 different species in it. It's going to be a lovely, colourful hedge, just waiting for it to grow. Now it'll take a couple of years. And around the farmyard, we have put in bird boxes and bat boxes. We're also rodenticide free. Back out in the field then as well, we've put in margins along field boundaries. We've put one in along a watercourse and another one on a south-facing ditch. And that just, it's just 3 metres out from the ditch, just to leave nature take its course. It'll be great for the butterflies and the bees and any insects, just to give nature a chance to give back a small bit. And we're not talking about a whole heap of ground, or we're not losing out acres to this, but we're doing a little bit, and we're going to see how it goes. The benefits are going to be amazing, just for our family and for our whole environment. And it really feels like you're giving back, you're doing something.
So we'll have a cup of coffee, Brenda?
Actually, lovely. Oh, great. Actually, a bit more milk, thanks.
Nice.
Norma and Tom, you're both a young couple. But I'm thinking about your three young children and your decision to keep going in farming. Was that a tough decision? Because I'm sure you want to, you know, do everything for the children and give them the best life that they can.
I think really we would never have actually made the move to become cheesemakers only for them. They were a huge part of the motivation to ensure that our farm was going to be financially sustainable into the future. Of course, for me, it gives me a better work-life balance. I'm here much more often. I can do all the school runs. You know, I can make it work around their day. And that's really important. And I think for them, they get to see their mum and dad working together, cooperating 99% of the time on most aspects of the business. You know, every decision, it's a joint decision, and they see us working very hard. And I think, you know, they'll grow up understanding what it takes to run a farm and to run a business. And, you know, that will stand to them.
Brenda, before you go, would you like some butter or cheese?
You know I would. Let me have a taste. That's lovely. Do you like it?
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Brenda.
Thanks very much, Brenda.
Bye, Brenda.
That was Brenda on Boruah Farm there with the Dineens, and you can find out more information about their lovely farm cheese at boruahfarm.ie. Finally this morning, I see our old friend Seamus O'Rourke, the lad from Leitrim, as he might call himself, has a new book out called A Lock of Poems, Recitations and Good Ones. He's published it himself, and it includes thoughts, poems, memories and stories, one or two of which you might have heard on this programme over the years. Now, all the details are on SeamusO'Rourke.com. But we have a yarn from Seamus, which he writes about Midnight Mass on Christmas Eve, and how, in his parish in Leitrim, the time of the Mass just had to be changed to 9 o'clock.
It all started harmless enough. Daddy went to town at 4 o'clock on Christmas Eve to buy Paxo for the stuffing. Mammy could make great stuffing if she had lots of Paxo. A 2 packets she wanted and a jar of pickled onions. The onions weren't for the stuffing, they were just nice things to have in the house at Christmas. Anything else? My father asked. My mother passed no remarks. She knew where the flicker was going, and she told him to leave the car at home, even though she couldn't drive right herself. My mother was always on the go, and my father was inclined to be very slow. Well, he walked slow with a limp, and now he was gone for a feed, a drink to the town, and to buy Paxo. Mammy took into a flitter of work. She washed and scrubbed and made dessert and changed the gas, and the evening went by very fast, and then it was time for midnight mass, and no sign of Daddy. She had to have a squig of brandy before she could drive, and we got to mass at 11:55. We couldn't get over the size of the crowd, and then Daddy and the boys came in from town. I know they were well cut. Little Tom and the Redfell and Joe Bunn, and their eyes sparkled as they sat down. Father Murphy eventually started Mass, but no one was listening because the men at the back were loudly whispering and telling yarns and Christmas stories. And then Little Tom made the strangest noise, and the altar boys were in stitches. It had the makings of a great Mass. Joe Bunn lit a fag, Little Tom had a drag, Mrs. Doyle turned round and lamped the two of them with her bag. The cigarette went into orbit and landed on that Mrs. Corbett with all the chins who had just discovered hairspray. The woman lit up like a blacksmith's furnace, and she was entitled to scream in all fairness. Her head was on fire, and her fur coat, well, mostly her collar, and Daddy got into fierce bother with a jar of pickled onions. He couldn't get the lid off to throw them on her. He tried dampening her down with the Paxo stuffing, but that did nothing except there was a lovely smell of sage and onion wafting up through the chapel. Father Murphy scowled from the altar, and Daddy took off for the holy water. And Daddy wasn't the right man to go with a bit of a limp and the walk and slow, and then genuflecting every chance he got, and there wasn't a lot left in the bowl when he did get back. Oh, the fire had spread, and this born-in woman had slipped all the way down to her corset. Mammy said that, Mrs. Corbett. If the wire goes in that, it'll take out the side wall of the chapel. Daddy doused her with the holy water, and magically the Christmas fire was over. We got home just in time for Santy, and a meeting was called by Father Murphy, and now midnight mass is at 9 in the evening, so that drinking men don't disrupt proceedings. We had Christmas dinner with no stuffing. Daddy was quiet, and Mammy said nothing. It was somber enough, but at least we had a real good fire that Christmas.
He hasn't lost it. Seamus O'Rourke, and details about his new book, A Lock of Poems, Recitations and Good Ones, available from SeamusO'Rourke.com. A wonderful Christmas present if you're still looking for one.